cherish the chance. Even when there's no one sitting there, but I shall is not a house, and a house is not a home when there's no one there to hold you tight and no one there.
And gentlemen, welcome, welcome, welcome to the French Connections Thursday edition. Today's date is the 5th day of June 2008. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith. Great to have you here for another overdue installment of the French Connection. If you'll allow my apologies to go out to all you listeners there who've been expecting more files to be done of late. Sorry about that. Things over here are getting back to normal a little bit. But we're going to have a guest today. We're going to talk about finances again, as we have done so often here on the French Connection, because I've said 1,000 times that this story is a financial one to be told. And, of course, all the usual suspects that we've discussed from the very beginning over the last 3 years, in fact, are the ones doing this implosion. But these financial problems are actually being translated out into the society as, war, rattlings and rumblings of war in Iran, problems with civil liberties in America. But if you go back to the root causes of this, you'll find out that it goes back to the banking system. It goes back to the fraud committed within our derivatives markets and the investment. It all goes back, actually, recently to the 2004 elimination of the Bank of International Settlements' use of gold as a backing of the currency for international transactions. What we've got, ladies and gentlemen, is a worldwide fiat system. There isn't a single bank left that does not use fiat money. And so, essentially, if all the central banks get on the same page, they can inflate us into a nightmare if they want to, and monetize the entire debt of their brothers in the banking industry. And who's going to suffer from that? Of course, you and me at the bottom, who have a stable paycheck coming in rather than a inflation-proof one. So I'm going to bring Mohammed up right now, and we've got a lot to talk about. Mohammed, are you with me?
I am indeed. Good evening, Daryl.
Well, it's great to have you back, Mohammed. You know, the thing about this this latest debacle that we're reading about here with Lehman's now, and we always knew after Merrill, Lehman's was next, and we know Lehman Brothers just recently had to admit to more problems, but it seems like to me that you discussed something with me today where they're actually trying to get... This is funny. They're actually posting as assets on their balance sheet things that are being written off as debt. I don't know how that works, but it seems like the most insane thing I ever heard of, but they're actually trying it, aren't they?
Well, they're able to claim that in the world of banking, Daryl, somebody that owes you money is technically an asset. The books of a bank are actually the other way round. To the way in which you would perceive them in an ordinary corporation.
That's right, yeah.
So they are allowed to actually claim that those things are assets.
But what I'm saying is, then, let me clarify the question. These are debts that they're claiming on their balance sheet today as assets because they're owed to them, but there's no way in this world or any other that those debts are ever going to be repaid. So basically they're posting onto their books assets that are fictitious if you take a look at the real world.
Well, then that, you've asked a different question there, Darryl.
Yeah.
What we're saying there is the important difference, which is crucial, which is how do you value those assets?
Mm.
And one of the issues is obviously the creditworthiness of the counterparty and whether or not they'll ever have the money. And clearly at the point that the counterparty doesn't have any money, you're supposed to represent that. And obviously what the banks are doing is ignoring the creditworthiness of the other side and just going on the straight market value of the asset, which is, of course, fraudulent.
Yep, yep. And this is the most frightening thing, because what's happening is the balance sheets of these financial institutions are actually, on paper, beginning to look like they're recovering, but in point of fact, they're actually deteriorating. And what happens is interbank transfers and interbank activity is going to dry up, because the other banks know full well that the stuff that's on these other balance sheets is a fraud.
Well, they all know they're telling the same lie, Darryl. That's part of the problem. The interesting elements of which there are a few which have come to light, which are all conspiring things which we've been telling faithful listeners to now for more than 6 months, since December last year, of the things which are coming to pass. One of them, Darryl, of course, is that the Fed has reached its limit of intervention.
Yep.
There was an article published last week on the Daily Telegraph website that explained that out of the $800 billion worth of short-term assets which the Federal Reserve Bank has in issue and is allowed to issue, $700 billion of them will have been given, exchanged, as we've been explaining people, the new lamps for old, swapping rubbish, failed products for government debt to keep these banks solvent. Apparently this month, June, is the month where the Fed actually has officially run out of assets. So anybody that comes knocking at the door saying we've got some more bonds that have failed us, the Fed is having to turn them away because it has no room left for intervention.
Well, what are they going to use as a prop now, except for these fraudulent postings on their balance sheets? What are they going to use?
Well, there is no prop, Darryl, and that's what's critical. We've reached one of two crunches. One is the limit for the central banks to intervene. They've intervened to the hilt, and they've got nothing left. We told people all along that the amount of real money which has been lost in the system is far greater than exists in the global money supply. Therefore, it is an exercise in futility to try and intervene in it. But the central banks have done, they've reached their limit. And that brings us to the second thing that we gave dates on, if people will go and listen to the files at the beginning of the year. We explained that people will start coming to the refinance window, if you remember, Darryl.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's very common for corporations to restructure their debts when they've got multiple issues of bonds out there. They quite legitimately can have cash flow issues and so want to borrow long to pay short. And the rate of failures in the bond market at the moment is so great that nobody's taking on new issues. And we're coming up to that one-year spot. You know, a lot of people were able to get refinancing up until October 2007.
Yep.
Those one-year bonds are starting to come in now. The ones that pay coupons annually, that pay their interest payments annually.
Yep.
They're starting to come on the horizon, Darryl. And the senior bond analyst at Dresden, Kleinwort Greaveson, was the largest merchant bank in the UK before Dresdner bought it. Their bond analyst has stated that failures now, defaults, are coming in waves. So maybe they haven't entirely been, they're not turning around saying we can't pay the maturity nominal out, but they're failing to meet their annual coupon payments, and it's happening in waves, and they're getting bigger and bigger, stronger and stronger, more and more bonds being reclassified as default now.
Well, now, give people an idea of the bond market size. What we're talking about here is a a credit method for large corporations that don't want to issue the dilutable stock offerings. They go to the banks, or they go to financial institutions, and what they do is they put together loan packages for expansion, for short-term needs, for the rest of it, and they issue on that paper bonds through these institutions. And basically, it is an option that most corporations, especially in Europe, because the Europeans have traditionally been more of a bond market user rather than the Americans, which have always gone to the, and I must say, to the credit of the American criminals, that they don't have to pay back when they do a share issue, a rights issue with shares. If you've got shares of nothing, then you get nothing. But there's no guarantees with a share. But with the bond, there is a guarantee that they give, or they say it's guaranteed, that they will pay you back at a forward date. And now what's happening is these contracts, these loans, these bonds are not going to be paid back. And what is the size of this market, Mohammed, just in general terms?
Well, it's absolutely vast, Darrell. I mean, it runs into the multiple trillions of dollars. You know, the borrowing is absolutely immense. Quite typically, British Telecom, which is a fairly large corporation here in the UK, they've, as I remember the last time I saw, the amount of borrowing that they'd done through this route was about $20 billion, £10 billion.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, been at different points in the company's history, different times they've gone to the bond market to raise money. And one of the things that's interesting about this, Daniel, as you quite rightly raised, is that, you know, they borrow at different terms at different times. Unlike stock, where a company issues shares to raise money, either as a rights issue to existing shareholders or by diluting it and creating new shares and selling them, whichever mechanism is used, what tends to happen is that with the bonds, that they're all repayable, and the borrowing is maybe for 3 years, for 5 years, for 10 years, for 20 years. It gets sized up to the single project maybe that it's raised for. What this means is that, you know, the guys in the finance department, say at British Telecom, who may have a dozen issues out there making up that £10 billion, some of the stuff matures after 2 years, some after 3 years, some after six. Some pays coupon, pays interest quarterly, others 6 monthly, others annually. So what happens is every so often these dates all conspire to them needing to make large payments, especially if there's a maturity payment. And maybe the cash flow of the company hasn't been that good that year. Well, had it, of course, been shares that had been issued, the company would just say, we're not paying a dividend. But as you've pointed out again, Darrell, the bonds, that coupon is guaranteed. They have to pay it. In fact, it's usually secured against the debts of the company.
Yep.
Or in the case of mortgage companies, it's secured against the actual properties that they're lending on. So quite often these have specific assets, or sometimes it just comes under insolvency law, what you can claim as a bondholder. But the rights of a bondholder in Europe, and especially the UK, are far stronger than those of a shareholder. So if a company gets wound up in the UK, the bondholders always get paid out before the shareholders do.
So now with the inability to conflate these different requirements they have going out into the future, and consolidate themselves into a single new bond, a new issue, because no one anywhere is buying or selling or even dealing a new bond issue for anybody. They've tried, Mohammed. They've put huge prices on these, which is basically what they are, is they're discount rates that go on to the repayment so that you can get a great return on these bonds. But even with these enormous returns, nobody's there to buy. There's just nobody out there willing to make a purchase in this market of any bond issues. So what we've had in the United States, for example, is the bond market is actually stalled. We've got Sallie Mae trying to sell student loan bonds that won't get sold. We've got muni bonds, municipal bonds, rupturing and going bad everywhere, and people trying to redo them. So this means cities and counties and small municipalities across America are finding out that they're facing a bankruptcy. This is a cascade now, and I don't see any stopping of it. And even if it gets into the courts, where the courts say, look, for the good of all, we're going to hold off on the judgments on these and make the people who took out the bonds not get paid for a short time. It doesn't matter what they do, because the enormity of this is going to overwhelm even a court system. There's nothing they can do to stop this implosion, Mohammed.
It's already overwhelmed the financial system, Daryl, so what on earth can a judge do after that? After the financial system itself is completely overwhelmed? Like you said, the student loan debacle in the States is just means that there'll be no money available for students when the term starts again at the beginning of the next year.
Yep.
The fact that you can't raise money as the student loan company is quite incredible. Then you've got municipality bond failure rates at the moment, Daryl. So far in the first 6 months of this year, we've had twice as many municipalities in the United States failing than in the whole of 2007.
Yep.
So we're on for, if that kind of trend remains, we're on for at least a fourfold increase in municipality failures. Now, you and I, if we were investors and we were thinking about our retirement, we'd saved some money, we would buy municipality bonds, Daryl, as a surefire guaranteed payout.
Well, they're almost every time, they're almost, because they're guaranteed by taxpayers, but they're almost always, in every instance, a AAA, aren't they?
Yep. They're strong, they're backed by tax dollars, and you know, they're the kind of things that people who don't want a tremendous return, they're looking for a reasonable return but no risk. That's the key point. We don't want any risk. Well, people who had that kind of an appetite for risk in the world, which was very risk averse, they're being hit and hit hard. And when those people are saying, hey, for what's happened, I might as well have put it on the horse.
Yep.
For the rate of return that we're getting, the level of risk that they've ended up facing is tremendous. And now, if all this in the bond market weren't bad enough, we had the very important announcement, Daryl, from Moody's at long last. You and I, we discussed the AMBAC MBIA bond insurance matter.
Yep.
Many times. See, we covered it before anybody else did.
We were doing it back at the end of November last year.
That's correct, Daryl. And I came back and we discussed even in February, March of this year, how fraudulent the situation was in maintaining the AAA ratings on these companies. And at that time, I believe AMBAC's share price had dropped 87%. Well, as at yesterday, the share price, Daryl, is now down 97% from where it was 12 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And senior credit analysts from all the major financial institutions are coming out and saying, you really are making a mockery out of the ratings now. They're saying this to S&P and Moody's. They're saying, if you expect us to keep a AAA rating on two companies, one of which has lost 97% of its value in 12 months and the other which has lost about 90%. If you expect us to keep accepting your AAA rating, we're not going to take you seriously on anything ever again.
But the consequences of allowing an AMBEC or an MBIA and the monolines to go under is huge. And see, what this does basically is say that there is no rating on any bond once those guys go belly up. And the fact is, because so many contracts have payouts tied to a rating moniker or tag that they put on it, AAA, AA, and the rates of return and the rates of repayment and the rates of the coupons and the forward trading of these instruments is tied to the rating. And now that the rating is going to go bad on the insurer of these bonds, this means that the backing of any of the bonds that came under AMBEC or MBIA's purview are now, in my view, defunct. They're void. They're not, because you paid a premium on top of the bond you bought to have an insurer cover that bond for its forward sale. And so basically, you're already being cheated out of the insurance policy you bought, and the bond itself is crap. So the whole thing is just a big, massive fraud.
You know, Darryl, people like to talk about subprime mortgages and subprime borrowing. And when you think about it, you know, what they're saying there is that money was lent to people to buy houses who really weren't credit worthy.
Yep.
To buy those properties. When we talk of bond insurance, I'm going to run this by everybody so they understand what we're talking about. Somebody whose bond is a subprime bond at the time that we design it and want to raise the money, our official status is subprime. And people said, hey, nobody's going to buy, you know, you and I, Darryl, we go out to try and raise some money to buy, I don't know, Renault or Fiat motor cars or something like that, and we want to issue a bond on the marketplace. And people say, hey, you know, Mohammed and Darryl, you two guys, you know, we've looked at how you structured this and we can't give you an investment grade. I mean, you're nobody, you're nothing, and you've got nothing behind you. There's no track record. And then up turns AMBAC or MBIA, and we say to them, listen, help us get this bond issue through, and we'll give you a kickback out of the money, say 1% or 2%. You just make sure we get through the ratings to the extent that the bond market think that we're a good enough bond for people to put their money in. So we're going from being a subprime bond now, Darryl, to an insured bond guaranteed by, like AMBAC, a $40 billion company 12 months ago, who were turning around at our $1 or $2 billion issue and saying, hey, we'll guarantee that. And the market said, hey, look, AMBAC, $40 billion company is personally guaranteeing. Usually they would guarantee maybe 50%.
Yeah.
Was maybe not 100%. 100%, it will be extreme junk, and no doubt they have done that on occasion. But the amount that they've insured of bonds is $1 trillion worth of payback. So if bonds in the market fail, they theoretically could have to pay out up to $1 trillion. And the interesting thing is that both of those companies leveraged their own AAA status and knowledge of the bond market to underwrite. Imagine that, Darryl. They had 1% of, or half a percent, whatever, of $1 trillion worth of bonds. They had these enormous income streams coming in from the issue of these bonds. But obviously, all these bonds are only got the ratings. These subprime bonds have got their enhanced, increased credit rating, their better rating, because of the quality of these two companies, their credit quality. When we downgrade that credit quality, obviously everything that they have underwritten automatically fails. These subprime bonds, we're no longer looking at these things through the rose-tinted glasses with AMBAC or MBI frames. We're now looking at the bond for real. We take the glasses off and we have to look at it and say, hey, this is a useless piece of paper. Why did I buy this? Oh yeah, because those guys over there insured it. But they're worthless now.
Well, even worse. Now, let's take a look. Let's go down that thread of taking the glasses off. When we take a look at who's behind this system, and I always want to get back to the Zionist Jewish element here, because that's the people doing us in. What is the story right now? What is the latest move here? Because I'm seeing these people looking for ways of crushing dissent. First of all, they're doing everything in their power to crush any dissent that there's out there against them. I don't know what's happening here, but I know the Fed, I know the Central Bank of Europe, I know the Bank of England, I know all of the major Western banks are in these people's hands. What is the upshot right now of their system? It must be failing for them as well. And where does gold come in this story?
Well, it is failing for them, Darryl, and I personally think that the reason that they got Moody's and S&P to keep telling the lies that they did
for the past 6 months is to buy themselves time to try and offload the rubbish that they themselves were holding. And the likes of myself and yourself, who actually understood what was really going on and spread that message out, has hampered their endeavours enormously. And many people in the professional markets, the professional bond markets, began to realise that certain players in that market were keeping this lie going. And they themselves were aware, like we were aware, that it was a lie. They tried, as I pointed out on your show earlier this year and at the end of last year, Darrell, they were trying to sell these bonds from their own portfolios into the portfolios of pension schemes and endowment policies, investment trusts that maybe you put up for your children. And by us exposing them, it's meant that they've had a very hard 6 months. They've kept these lies going for 6 months, but because the market's been so sparse in terms of the number of people prepared to buy and sell because they were aware there were lies going on, they are still stuck with them. So they themselves are going to be caught with a loss in the middle of all of this, in spite of their best endeavours.
Now, where does gold... Let me see. I've been watching the most manipulated market I've ever seen is the precious metal markets, and I can't help but be shocked at times that this precious metal market is being suppressed the way it is with funny money. They're using fraudulent valued dollars and euros across the world to keep the value of gold conspicuously depressed. And how much longer, in your view, can they keep that farce going? And what is the real value of gold in relation to what the currencies are right now?
Well, of course, the currencies, the paper currencies themselves, the dollar is massively overvalued compared to where it should be. The euro is about right. Sterling is also massively overvalued. Sterling is about to take the same kind of dive that the dollar did. The economy here, there was a sneak report that came out last week. It was buried very quickly, Darrell. 250,000 homes in the UK now have negative equity because of the 7% drop in house prices on average across the country last year. Just 7% and a quarter of a million houses got negative equity.
That's the start, though, isn't it? That's only the beginning, really.
Oh, we're scratching the surface here, Darrell. We're scratching the surface. Such a small dip in house prices, only 7%. And yet that's enough to bring 250,000 homes into negative equity. That's just really scary. You know, you start thinking, well, if we get a 40% drop, what are we looking at there? I mean, it's just, it beggars belief, really does beg a belief what the potential here is. I would have personally expected, you know, a 20% drop and a couple of 100,000. 7% and a quarter of a million means there's some serious over-leverage going on out there. So the UK economy, in summing, is going to catch up with the US economy on this one, Darrell. In terms of gold, will we try to educate listeners previously on this one as well, of course, Mr. Rothschild used to set the price of gold on his own, Darrell. And although he got rid of that system so that he did not get publicly embarrassed by it becoming common knowledge that that was going on, it's really difficult to believe that the system that he allowed to be put in its place was one that he could still not exercise some kind of control and leverage over, albeit from the shadows or behind a curtain.
Yeah.
So the man who had full control over it took one step back, as he likes to do, so his name was not on any of the paperwork, like he did with Cecil Rhodes and various other peoples, Rockefeller and Schiff, people who fronted his money. He's very common. This is his modus operandi. He doesn't like his name plastered all over the place. He likes it to make it look like there's lots of other people at it. He's obviously created a replacement to the mechanism he had previously, which he is still able to pull the strings on. Which means that, Darrell, we see many decent people creating a demand on gold, especially physical gold, so high that the bullion houses of America can't cope.
They can't deliver. No, there's absolutely no ability right now for these majors to houses to deliver their sales.
Oh, and the order book is 3 and 4 months in advance now. So if you go in there and say, "Hey, bring me 5 kilos of gold," they say, "Certainly, Daryl. You'll need to come back in about 4 months. We'll take $5,000 deposit for the moment, just so we know you're serious, and you'll have to pay the balance on whatever the price is on that day." I mean, it's that bad. So something which is in such tremendous demand, and then we see the price isn't moving anywhere. So we know that the normal laws, Daryl, as you would expect to see of supply and demand, are not applying to this particular asset at all.
Yeah. Well, you know, Mohammed, I see a failure worldwide. I got on South African radio 2 days ago. I mentioned it to you. And I told the listeners in South Africa and across Africa, in fact, this is sent out by satellite, so I was listened to by millions, that this is the end. This is the end of the modern debacle system, this fiat money system that has been put in place, this usury system, this criminal system. And what's going to replace it is going to be decided upon by either the people who've been victimized or by the people who did it. Now, how we're going to affect the change on our own behalf is the big question we need to start asking. And I asked the South African people, I said, first of all, you've got to become self-sufficient in foodstuffs and the rest in order to be around so that we can battle for the control of what's going to happen on the planet. But we are in a situation now, unseen in my life, I can't even remember reading a history book where a global implosion of this magnitude was even hinted upon. I mean, you know, the fall of Rome didn't have this kind of implication for the world. I don't see any place in the history books where it got this bad ever.
Indeed, Dal, the fall of Rome only harmed the Romans. For the rest of people who were held up in slavery or had been farming, they actually did rather well out of it. So that was nothing compared to what's going to happen here, clearly. The fact that the central banks can't intervene, especially the Fed, the fact that the ratings are about to go, the fact that the bond failures are coming wave upon wave, somebody somewhere is going to be left holding the parcel, you know. And, you know, when the music stops and they take the wrapper off, it's going to be empty, Daryl. And they all paid, you know, $100 per bond to be involved in this to start with. So people are going to have to look for alternatives when their investments dry up, which clearly they're going to. Many people have been relying on these things. Pensioners like their municipality bonds, and I'm very concerned for them, Daryl. If that was somebody's pension and they bought bonds in a particular municipality and that municipality is now bankrupt and unable to make that payment, not only have they lost their income, but they've lost the money that they put in there to get the income. There's nothing between them and the street, Daryl. It's gone.
Well, you know, we've got a situation where, you know, there's people advocating now for a return to gold standard. And I've often said that these disgorgements of the central banks that have gone on throughout the 90s were not done by mistake. They were done with a malice of forethought in that large amounts of delivered gold in bullion form was being disgorged from these central banks to points unknown. And it's interesting that these sales were made in blocks. These purchases were not, you know, divvied out to the jewelry market or to the, you know, to the gold coin dealer market. These things were picked up by the big guys. And but then, you know, what's going to happen is when this paper system, this fiat system that everyone knew would fail because an interest-based usury system always fails, they knew that gold would come back into play at some point. And is it the same usual suspects that are now sitting on top of mountains of our bullion that are going to come back in and offer us a system they control once again?
Well, of course, Darryl, the bullion market is quite unique in the world, in that because it's a market which has central bank purchases and sales going on, as well as interventions, it is quite common within that market for transactions to be classified, thereby not revealing the identities of the parties either buying or selling. The argument is that there are political reasons for that. What that meant is that, say, for instance, when Gordon the Moron Brown was selling off the Bank of England reserves, which we've had for more than 200 years, at $260, $280, very low prices, Darryl, less than $300, sometimes $320 maybe, but bargain basement prices, huge quantities. Because it was a central bank engaged in the sale, they were able to invoke the secrecy law. So whoever had been going in doing the purchases, also, by definition, their identities remain classified.